Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is Richard Benulli. Today we have Joseph Wang and Ira Harris. Joseph spent 5 years studying the plumbing of the financial system as a senior trader on the open markets desk. The desk sits at the center of the dollar system as its ultimate and infinite provider of dollars. It has access to virtually all regulatory and financial data, as well as open lines of communication with all major market participants. One of the few places in the world where one can definitively learn how the system works. And prior to joining the desk at the Fed, Joseph was a credit analyst, and in another life, he practiced law. Ira is an independent trader, hedge fund manager, and global macro consultant, trading foreign currencies, equities, bonds, and commodities for over 40 years. He was also CME director from 1997 to 2003, and also a stint most recently. Welcome, gentlemen.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to meet both of you.
Yeah, this is great. Thank you. Thanks, Richard, for putting us together as usual. Great.
I thought we'd begin with just a global macro view on the economy and the financial markets overall. Your thoughts, Joseph?
I think we're actually, the way that I think of global macro, I feel like we're heading into a different regime now. And it's a regime with structurally higher inflation. And that has a lot of implications for monetary policy and financial assets. I think we're heading into a world with structurally higher inflation because it's because of demographics. If you look at a demographic chart, you'll see that over the past few decades and maybe the past few hundred years, what we've had is continually growing population. We've had more and more people entering the workforce. But that all changed a few decades ago. Two things changed. The first is that, well, people started living longer. We had advances in medicine, so their life expectancies are much higher, like around 80 years old now. And the second thing that happened over the past few decades is that we have fewer children. So, you know, if you think back 100 years ago, a family would have three, four, or five kids. Now we're maybe two or maybe less on average. So this combines into a world where we have a shrinking workforce and we have a lot of older people. So you can think of the dependency ratio as going much, much higher. So fewer people supporting more people who are not working. Now that means that structurally wages are going to have to go higher because there's less labor. Now, if you have wages higher, that fuels into being wages being a huge input into basically everything that we produce, we are going to have higher prices. You can actually see this. This is always going to happen, but you can see it being accelerated recently due to the pandemic. What the pandemic did was that it actually caused a lot of people who are about to retire, the baby boomers, to retire earlier. So if you look at a chart with labor force participation, it all dropped significantly in 2020 as we were all forced to stay home. And now everyone's bounced back, with the exception of those age 65 and above. Those people left the labor force and they did not come back. Their labor participation rate did not come back in the same extent. So we're already seeing this negative labor force shock, and it's going to only get worse over time. That means that wages that we see right now as a big driver of inflation is going to be structurally higher going the next few years. That has implications for monetary policy because that means that rates are going to also have to go higher and stay higher for the foreseeable future, try to tamp down inflation, provided that the central bank continues to target 2% inflation. Another way you can think about this is that structurally speaking, we're going to have lower real growth in the coming decades. Growth at a high level is just, you can have growth if you have more inputs or if you have more better technology. That is to say, out of the same inputs, you get more outputs. If you have a major input, labor, that's declining, it's very likely that you're going to have lower growth. If you have lower growth, And you have a lot of people who are not working but continue to consume, like the retirees. That means you're going to have higher real rates to entice people who are producing to not produce so that people who are not working can consume. So if you have this outlook that rates, real rates, and nominal rates, of course, are going to be higher in the future, that has enormous implications for asset prices, because many people price assets based upon rates. If you have a fixed income portfolio, obviously that means you have loss. That will mean you probably have losses going forward. You see that a lot happening this year already with a more aggressive Fed. But that also affects all their asset classes, because oftentimes investors hold a diversified portfolio of fixed income and equities and maybe other stuff. And if you have part of your portfolio, fixed income, declining in value, oftentimes you will have to sell your other parts of your portfolio to rebalance. And so that mechanically bleeds into equity prices, causing equity prices to decline. So that's my currently what I see in the global economy right now. I think the central banks are still grappling with this. They're trying to do the right thing. And so what we see in the US is also mirrored in the UK, Europe, not Japan, but maybe later, that they're trying to aggressively stop inflation, and it's having the predictable impact.
Interesting. And your thoughts, Ira?
Well, I'm very aware of the demographic arguments, and I've read so much of the data, but I'm in my greater concern, and as we've talked about quite a bit, Richard, over the years already, I go back to the 70s, and I was never a fan of the Phillips curve, because I didn't think the Phillips curve had great validity. Because even when I was in university and graduate school, my work was done in global macro, believe it or not, in the 70s, looking at multinational corporations and from a political standpoint, as well as a financial and economic standpoint, the impact that they had on the world. And the Phillips curve, to me, until I knew what the assumptions that they were building into their models, didn't take in, it left the employment situation as a heavily domestic outcome. And I was already seeing with the way that U.S. corporations, due to the overvalued dollar, were busy moving and purchasing assets all over the world to try to take advantage of the strong dollar, the artificially strong dollar, I might add, coming out of Bretton Woods. And using that to purchase assets on the cheap. Then we have, of course, the fall of the Berlin Wall, and even more than that, 1979, when Deng Xiaoping takes over China and tries to undo so much of what Mao had done. We're unleashing a global workforce. So globalization is an enormous impact. You cannot. Because that's what, to me, allowed the Fed to pretend that they had a handle on inflation. Because that was the culmination of Donald Trump being elected. Because where I grew up in the Rust Belt America, labor was so put upon, and it still is. We're coming out of it, and I think that's what Joseph speaks to, because if we're going to have sticky higher wages because of the dynamic due to demographics as well as to globalization, because I think globalization is under threat, that we will have inflation, as we would say, sticky upwards, and that rates are going to have to be higher, especially on the short end. Because to me, if any central bank is going to combat inflation, they have to do it on the short end. Real yields need to go higher on the short end. Paul Krugman wrote a piece on Friday that I couldn't disagree with more. If you want to combat inflation, when things are normal and things are good, we can have a different discussion. But if you're a central bank combating inflation for whatever reasons, and Joseph's reasons absolutely because he's not the only one. There are a lot of people in that camp on the demographics, and wages are sticky up, and you're going to combat that. Well, you're going to have to keep real yields on the short end in a positive nature. We're not close to that. You know, I and I'm sure we'll speak more about it, but I listened to Christine Lagarde. They talk about 1.25 interest rates as being significant when inflation by her own measure is 8.3%. Well, let's cut the joke already. You know, so in looking at that, and if we get into a deglobalization period, then I think we could throw whatever numbers you think are going to be there, it's going to be even that much more dramatic. You know, as we go onshoring, we're already seeing it, right? The Biden administration is shaking in their boots about a railway strike of 115,000 railroad workers come Friday. I mean, they're doing their best to head it off. But listen, I come from a family. My grandparents were union people. And proud of it. And to me, I always say, public sector unions, different story. Private sector unions, go fight and battle for every dime you can get. And they've been at a loss for so long. So we're starting to see that change. So I think Joseph's points are well taken. How high will rates have to go until that's going to be the unknown question.
I think those are really great points, especially globalization. I don't feel like many economists saw that. I mean, they focused domestically, as you mentioned, but if you look at what happened post the ascension of China into the WTO, their exports to the world just exploded. Basically, as you noted, hundreds of millions of people joined the global labor force. Now, obviously, that has a big impact on global inflation. And if that goes away, it's going to probably have a very big reverse impact. And I would also note that countries like China are also aging rapidly. So their workforce is actually declining at a faster rate than the US. And rates definitely have to go much higher to solve that. What we have now is just not realistic.
Mm-hmm. And if we look at monetary policy and fiscal policy, do you see a sort of balance happening whereby there's more of a conservative, hawkish Federal Reserve or major central bank policy being balanced with this inflationary environment or inflationary fiscal policy?
Well, I think the point about, so I think there's a really important point is that monetary policy is really not all up to the Fed, and nor is fiscal policy all up to the fiscal authorities. And let me explain. When you're the Fed, you have tremendous influence over interest rates. And the biggest borrower in the United States is the federal government. So when you're raising rates, you're basically increasing the interest rate payments of the federal government. So you're having an impact on fiscal policy. They're going to have to either raise taxes or issue more debt. And on the other side of the equation, fiscal policy also influences monetary policy a lot as well, because how the US Treasury decides to issue debt affects interest rates. So let's say the US government decides to issue a whole bunch of 10 years, 30 years. Well, that's going to put upward pressure on longer term interest rates. So this whole, you know, monetary inflation, fiscal structure, that they're all connected and they're not really independent of each other. Another thing I would note is that in the financial system, so as we know, commercial banks create money when they make credit, but the fiscal authorities also create money when they issue debt. So if you think about it, a $100 bill is something that's created by the US government, right? $100 in treasuries is in many ways kind of like money that pays interest. It's risk-free and also very liquid. So when you have the fiscal authorities, the federal government going out and basically doing extreme deficit spending, which is basically paying for goods and services by printing treasury securities, that's obviously inflationary. That's like helicopter money printed out of nowhere to go and purchase items. And that's not something the Fed has any control over. So that is obviously a huge problem in their fight to get inflation under their control. If you look at the forecast for the Congressional Budget Office, the deficit is going to be basically $1 trillion a year for the foreseeable future. That is a lot of, you can say, treasury printing, which is obviously going to be an inflationary impulse. Now, this is very different from how the federal government was run, let's say, in the past 20 years. If you look at the deficit for the past 20 years, we actually had people who were concerned about having a balanced budget, although they're all gone now. And so we're all full speed ahead, MMT style almost, of just spending and spending and spending. Now, that's going to make the Fed's job very difficult, because if you have, on the one hand, this actor here, the federal government, engaging in deficit spending, you're the Fed, your tools are interest rates. Now, that works on the private sector, because if you're a private actor and you have higher rates, maybe you spend less. But it doesn't work on the public sector, because the federal government doesn't care about interest rates. So it makes your job to contain inflation much more difficult. And of course, there's also a political aspect. If the duly elected representatives of our country want to engage in inflationary policy, want to boost the income of labor, for example, you don't really feel like you have a mandate to push against that, to raise rates and push against Congress. And that seems to be how Arthur Burns felt in the 70s. And so it's going to make things very difficult. And I'm not quite sure how it will be resolved. Oftentimes I hear people compare the 70s to today, and I wasn't practicing around there. You have a wealth of experience over the decades. I'd be very interested in hearing how you compare the two eras.
Well, you know what? I think it's a false comparison. And I'll tell you, because again, and I've thought this for years, and I've written about it for years, because private sector unions in the 70s, I mean, that's why we got cost push, right? Everybody thought, we don't have cost push, because unions have had, globalization broke the back of the unions by design. You know, Thomas Piketty, his book, and I can't claim I read the whole book, but
it's a big book.
I know, but I read, you know, several articles that he wrote that went into it. And being that I was reared in a much more Marxist economic viewpoint when I was learning about economics, both Marxist and Austrian, because I went to University of Wisconsin for graduate school, and the professors I had, that's what they were teaching, both sides. So you really learned, and it was a great time, because it was the Marxists who really were aware of what was going to take place with the petrodollar recycling. Nobody else was paying attention to it. They said, you know, you're walking into a bad situation here. That view was so indoctrinated me that it kept me from getting a job when I went out to work to try to get a job when I left college at the beginning of 1977. And I went to Chicago, where I was from, and I had learned all these things. And I went into banks that where I'd gotten interviews, saying how their third world loans were going to blow up. And they kind of laughed at me, because no, this is the greatest lending we're doing, because they were just looking at the interest. But I think the Marxists, and of course the Austrians, were absolutely on top of it. We're not there because we don't have at this juncture cost push. And you also didn't have the globalization impact. China was still struggling under Mao. I probably argue until 75 or 76. Mr. Zhou Enlai dies, and I think Mao starts to slip. And then you get Deng Xiaoping, and Deng Xiaoping had a great line. I read Ezra Vogel's wonderful biography recently on Deng Xiaoping, and Deng Xiaoping said, and it's a great line, I think we can all learn from it, is practice is the sole criterion for judging truth. And then China starts to take off, because it wasn't for a lack of intellectual ability, for knowledgeability. Mao had stifled it. If, you know, we can argue whether it was good or bad, but the world now starts to change dramatically. By 89, it's in full swing. Globalization, the communists have basically been defeated. And as some people say, it's the end of history. I never believed that. But we have a change. The 70s were totally different. And it especially changes, and everybody, I think, sees it when Reagan broke the air traffic controllers. The private sector understood what was taking place. and reacted accordingly. And then they started moving capital. And really, when you look at what capital has done, and as Piketty would say, R is greater than G, well, there's a reason for it, because capital was able to arbitrage 2 billion new workers onto the global scene. That's what it did. It moved, and it would move. And as long as the governments, and Bill Clinton was a big proponent of it, you know, so we lived through these times. So I Joseph, I don't think the '70s, I think it's a very false comparison. You really have to stretch yourself. And when they say find your inner Volcker, I'm interested to hear you, because I don't believe that for a minute. Because as I say, Paul Volcker could not be Paul Volcker with the huge amount of debt that you were talking about. With when you start raising interest rates, he would have brought the world, not just the US, but he would have brought the world to a massive depression. We can argue that he basically did anyway, because we get the Mexican crisis. We get a lot of crises in there, which of course the Marxist analysts were 100% right, that with the huge recycling of the petrodollar, where did they go to? They went to countries who were importing massive amounts of energy and food, because who else needed that kind of money? So you had Saudi Arabia and you had all the OPEC nations who were sitting on a sea of liquidity, who were then sending it to Chase Manhattan and chemical, and they were busy recycling it to those who needed the money, who were the lowest level borrowers in the world, those who are just trying to meet their import bills. Now, I think we have a similar situation, but for different reasons. I think the strong dollar is a real danger, but it was for Volcker too, by the way. But Volcker didn't have to deal with the debt levels that Jerome Powell. So there is no inner Volcker to me, because Paul Volcker couldn't have found it. And he had James Baker, because James Baker was politically astute enough to say, this strong dollar is causing domestic political, which it was, because the strong dollar was causing the offshoring of so much manufacturing, right? And so they have to intervene with the Plaza Accord to stem the rise of the dollar. So we, in certain ways, yes. So I'll stop there, because I know you have phenomenal amounts of to speak to.
No, that it does sound like there are a lot of structural differences between the 70s and today. And I definitely agree with you. I don't think there's going to be a Volcker moment here. And I think there's a couple of reasons why I don't think that. One is that it seems like the politics and culture today are very different than it was in Volcker's time. In Volcker's time, we had a public that was very tired of inflation. So he had a lot of popular support to be able to do what he would do. We had, you know, a long time of high inflation. The public was tired of it. Today, what I hear in the press, it's, and in the FOMC minutes themselves, there seems to be a lot of fear about tightening too much and causing too much unemployment. So oftentimes we think of, and you know, the Phillips curve, it's not super accurate, but if you, you know, hike rates a lot, you're probably going to cause some economic slowdown. You're going to have a little bit more unemployment. There is going to be some sort of trade-off there between inflation and unemployment. And from what I see in the press and see from what I hear from the Fed, it seems like they're very reluctant to make any sorts of trade-off between unemployment and inflation. So they definitely don't seem to have the stomach to accept that kind of economic damage. The debt level, of course, also is an issue. I think of the debt level as actually making the transmission of monetary policy much stronger. And so it actually makes, let's say, a 20% Fed funds rate that Paul Volcker did, not necessarily. I think of it as being a stronger transmission of policy, is because when you raise rates just a little bit, you're basically shaving off a lot of wealth in the economy. The amount of wealth you shave off is in proportion to the level of debt. So if you think of monetary policy as transmitting by, let's say, reducing the wealth of the public, thus they don't have enough money to spend, as much money to spend to push up prices, and then you say that a lot of their wealth is held in some form of debt, well, then you hike rates a little bit, everyone loses a ton of money, and you know, it's, you don't have to go as high to accomplish the same thing. And I'd also note that a lot of the debt is also public, and the federal government just doesn't care about that. The dollar system also is much stronger today than it was back in the 80s. So the dollar is much more widely used, and the level of dollar debt and assets outside of the country is much higher. And that also makes the transmission of monetary policy even stronger globally. So, you know, if you just hike a little bit, not just you would affect the US, but I think it has a very big effects abroad. As you noted, I think the effects abroad would be actually even greater than in the past, simply because there's so much more dollar denominated instruments, and all that stuff is going to be directly priced off of US dollar rates. So I don't think we'll have to go as high. I do think we can go, you know, just a little bit more, and we'd have a pretty big impact.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I don't look at it that the dollar, the huge debt overhang slows it down, but there are some negative politics to that, because as I tell people right now, if you 18 months ago, were you still at the Fed 18 months?
I left the Fed in June 2021. So
when I have to put up a T-bill for margin, so if I put up it was a joke. I mean, I wouldn't even buy it because the amount of that I was going to earn. I mean, you could buy $1 million T-bill 18 months ago, and on a year T-bill, maybe you were going to earn $300, $500. I mean, I'm talking real numbers. That same, and I just did it, that $1 million T-bill today will earn you $32,500. And it's more.
Well, that's a lot more.
That's a significant amount of money. But that also affects government policy, because the amount of interest on the debt now becomes serious. You know, at zero, everybody said, oh yeah, we're carrying a lot more debt, but the cost of carrying it, you know, I picture Steve Leisman on CNN, oh, don't worry about it. The cost of, now it's going up and up and up, and people are staying to the short term, myself included. Why, I don't have to go out and buy a 10-year treasury day. Why should I do that? I run capital risk, especially, and I hope we're going to go there next. As quantitative tightening, for lack of a better word, begins, we don't know what the impact is going to be. I don't think the Fed, I mean, I've looked at the models. I've looked at what the Kansas City Fed has modeled as to how you go about this. But I don't think that anybody really knows. And when we saw Powell, and I'm not a Powell fan. I thought in 2018 he was getting ahead, but I thought he had to do one or the other. And I still think you either raise rates almost in a Taylor rule fashion to get short-term yields to a real yield instead of being negatives, or take them up and then start on quantitative tightening and see what happens. As Stanley Druckenmiller, who I have great respect for, as he said in December of 2018, when we were already seeing Powell pivot away, Druckenmiller said it was a mistake to go what he called the double shotgun approach, both raising rates and quantitative tightening. Because we've never been down the road of quantitative tightening. Yeah, okay, you know, we can talk about the Accord of 1951, but the quantitative tightening in this way, we don't know. So I'm dying to hear your thoughts on how this plays out, because you know what, I thought 9 months ago, and I was very open about it in my blog, go to 3%, go to 2%, say this is where we're going to, and now we're going to let quantitative tightening go, and we're going to see, and if it's having the impact that we think, which is, as you allude to, I think there's going to be a massive deleveraging of the system. Again, I don't think the Fed knows how to measure how much leverage is in the system. And I think that's where they get caught off. So I'm going to stop and listen to you.
What are your thoughts?
I think that's a really good point. I mean, well, first, actually, I want to mention the federal government interest point that you made. That's a big deal, because the level of debt is so high and it's growing, and all of that was accumulated in a period of very low interest rates. So if interest rates are structurally going to stay higher, pretty soon you're going to have so much the federal government is going to pay a lot of interest, right? So the way that it pays it, it's very difficult to raise taxes. It just means it's going to have to issue more treasuries. So you almost enter into this doom loop where you just continue to print these sovereign liabilities. That's not sustainable. It'd probably be arrested by the Fed, who will buy everything and do some sort of yield curve control. But then you have financial repression, keeping real rates very low. It's a kind of a disaster, but we're not there yet. We're probably a few years away from that, I think. Quantitative tightening, I think, is going to be a really big deal. And at a high level, the way that I think about it is that quantitative tightening does two things. One is that it increases the amount of duration the market has to hold. So whatever the Fed used to hold is now going to be held by the market. At the end of the day, there's a series of transactions where that happens. And the second thing that it does is that it takes liquidity out of the financial system. So you can think of a quantitative easing. Fed creates money out of thin air, buys treasuries, and quantitative tightening reverses that. Market holds more treasuries, and the money that was created disappears. I think it's going to be disruptive for a couple reasons. Now, I like to think of rates in the treasury markets as just supply and demand. So on the supply side, as I've alluded to before, the amount of treasuries that are being issued is very large. So the primary deficit, it's like, I think it's $800 billion this year, and for the foreseeable future, it's going to be like $1 trillion. So we're going to have $1 trillion net new issuance for the foreseeable future. Pre-pandemic, that was about $500 billion. So it's a step up change. But QT adds to that, because now what the Fed is holding, the private market will have to hold. And that's $60 billion a month, that's $720 a year. So you add that together, you're going to have a net issuance. The private sector is going to have to hold a little bit more than, say, $1.5 trillion in issuance this year and the next. And that's a tremendous amount of treasuries that the market will have to absorb. Now, if it was in the form of T-bills, easy to digest, easy to absorb, but it's not. That's kind of the crazy thing. If you look at the treasury refunding statement, they're actually cutting coupons the past few quarters. So it's going to be largely in longer duration coupons. That's the one point, enormous amounts of supply that will make it disruptive. The second point is that, just looking at the demand side, I'm not really sure who's going to be able to absorb all that. Now, if you look before the pandemic, the marginal buyers were the hedge funds. They were doing their cash futures basis trades, and they bought several $100 billion worth of treasuries on a levered basis, funded in repo. That's all gone now. The public data is very clear. They all delivered after March 2020. Post 2020, the marginal buyer was obviously the Fed, buying tons of treasuries through their QE program, and the commercial banks, and that's all public as well. They had enormous amounts of deposit inflows, and they were deploying that in treasury securities, and that's all gone too. They've noted in their quarterly calls that they're not buying anymore, see it in the public data as well. So we have all the marginal buyers from the past few years gone, and we have tremendous amounts of issuance, and the market is very, very poor in liquidity right now. That's just a very, very fertile environment for something to break. I think of it as a QT time bomb. And the way that I look at this is informed by what happened in the repo market in 2018, September 2019. So we saw repo rates that were about 2% spike up to as high as 10% intraday. Now, for those of you who don't know, repo is a super, super liquid market. There's about $1 trillion in cheesy repo done every day. It's a very stable, very, very liquid market, far more liquid than the cash treasuries market. And if such a liquid market can just kind of break and go from like 2% to 10%, that really opens up the possibilities of what cash treasury market could do. So I think QT will be much more impactful than the Fed suggests. I think Governor Waller has gone on and said, oh, well, research suggests that it's about around 50 basis, 2 trillion in QT is about 50 basis points in rate hikes. Yeah, I don't think that's going to happen.
Richard, you want to, we're talking through you and I don't want to do that.
Yeah. I mean, so therefore, do you think there will be continued QT, or at some point will there be a so-called Fed pivot? Under what conditions do you see that happening, Joseph?
I think so, because I think the Fed is very concerned about unemployment over inflation. Apologies. So I think that when we have higher unemployment, they might be more persuaded to be able to pivot or at least pause the rate hikes. And the economy could be stalling, let's say, within 6 months. So it's possible. The market obviously thinks of this Fed. Powell is very famous, for example, for having pivoted in January of 2019. If you recall, in December of 2018, Powell and the FOMC were telling the markets that we're going to hike a few times in 2019. Then the equity markets tanked and they did just totally a 180. And it just cemented Powell's reputation as Powell the pivoter. And the market sees that. And they also know that that they're very concerned about unemployment. So they're seem to be pricing in some rate cuts next year. I think that's not unreasonable, actually, despite notwithstanding what Powell and the FOMC team have been trying to push into the market, that they're going to stay higher for longer. If they cut rates, usually according to the FOMC's way of operating, they don't want to be, let's say, doing one thing with the balance sheet and then doing something in the opposite on with the funds rate. So, for example, we are hiking rates, but we're also doing QT. We're doing them at the same time. We're doing hawkish policy. Or when we're cutting rates, we're also doing QE, right? We're doing something dovish with the federal funds rate and dovish with the balance sheet. So, if there's a pivot in the federal funds rate, then to me, that suggests that it would also make sense for them to stop QT because they want to be have these two instruments, the balance sheet and the federal funds rate, acting in the same direction. So if there's a pivot in the federal funds rate next year, I think we could have a pause in QT. I don't think that's for sure. It really depends on how the economic evolves and how bad inflation gets.
Your thoughts, Ira, on that?
I know it's I wonder about these things, and I know that Joseph has firsthand experience. So with QT, and again, I don't know from a trading standpoint, because everything I have to think and do, I put into a trading view or an investment view. And I've watched the yield curve invert, say 210, 530. They've been acting actually against each other, but I think that's the difference because one is more institutional and one is more spec. I always view the 530 as a much more trader speculators type of area, and the 210 is much more institutional. But and I'm watching this closely, and today I mean the curves have flattened or inverted more today fairly sizably because the market really got caught off by that inflation by the CPI number, although they shouldn't have. I think the Fed has really missed the boat on understanding OER, owner's equivalent rent. And I think wrongfully, by the way, because I take Peter Bookvar and Jimmy Bianco, who I've done podcasts with Richard with, and they've talked about that this was going to be a lagging albatross around their neck because the way that the BLS measures it, and that it's and it does lag, and sure enough, it's really causing them a lot of problems. But that's besides the point. So, if we're not going to get to real, a real positive real yields on the short end, I'm really kind of surprised that the curve is inverting. Now, historically, yeah, that's the case. And when you talk about your inner Volcker, the curve. The yield curve with what Volcker did went to negative 600 basis points. It all depends what we want to use. If I use overnight money, it probably went to 800 basis points, negative inverted. We're not going to do anything of the sort because Powell has showed us, again, as Joseph says, is concerned about unemployment. And I think that's right. He as I, because I'm not a Powell fan, I said, he during COVID, he became the Minister of Social Justice. Because the battle cry was everybody who lost a job through no fault of their own, we're going to stay with quantitative easing, and we're going to stay loose. And I think it's come back to haunt them quite a bit, by the way, but we'll see where they get cold feet. But it does raise the question of two things. Philip Jefferson and Lisa Cook are now Fed governors. I have yet to hear a word from them. I hear everybody chirping. I hear Waller. I hear, we can go on and on. Brainerd's been out this week. She was quiet for a while. We certainly hear from the Fed presidents. They must be getting paid by the word, because they do talk a lot. But I'm waiting. Now, Lisa Cook and Phil Jefferson are labor economists. How much will they tolerate here, especially as real wages fail to keep up? So if real wages don't keep up, now you're going to say, well, that means we have to go more aggressively. But that means that unemployment goes to where Larry Summers has said, to 5.5 to 6%. I don't think that this Fed has that stomach, or Powell has never shown that. So that's a question that I raised. And then with quantitative tightening, I really thought the curves would start to steepen, because when the Fed was building its $9 trillion balance sheet, as far as I know, and I'm pretty sure about this, and Joseph will weigh, when you start to put coupons into private hands, these people are hedgers. When you unload all those mortgage-backed securities, that's going from the Fed, from the Fed's hands to private individuals who will have to hedge them. So you get a new seller. So I'm a little nervous. I think long rates, I think duration, the further out duration, are going to go far higher, even if the Fed, you know, especially if the Fed stops, because why do I want to own that? Right now, I'm doing better if I buy a one-year T-bill and I don't run capital risk than if I buy a 10-year that may yield, what am I looking at, 3.43 today, but I'm running a lot of capital risk because, I'm one who believes that mortgage rates are going to be 8% in 6 months. I just don't see a way around it unless the Fed were to end QT. I don't see a way around it, because you've got all these players in the market now who have to hedge themselves, who may unload stuff. So who's going to be the buyers? And you don't have the global buyers, meaning I don't think China's coming to the rescue. And I think the Japanese, especially if they come and do something with the yen, a lot of those swaps that take place now are going to be over, and a lot of that demand is going to disappear. So it wouldn't surprise me to see the long end really start to fluctuate a lot more than we've seen.
How do you see the different points in the yield curve evolving, Joseph?
I'm on the same page as Yara. And, absolutely. I'm surprised by the curve not steepening and the long end not selling off. I think that what it will happen, it's just not happening yet as QT gets more into progress. One of the things that I see in the treasury market is that there's a lot of buying there that doesn't actually have to do with anything with inflation or growth or fundamentals. The U.S. treasuries play this special role in the global financial system as a safe asset. So you're going to have a lot of people who just have to hold them. For example, banks, they have to buy them for their part of their liquidity buffer. That's one source of inelastic demand. You have all these foreign reserve managers. Well, let's say if you're a foreign country and you suddenly sold a lot of stuff to the U.S., you got a bunch of dollars, you have to put them somewhere. Well, where do you put them? Well, put them in treasuries. Why? Because, you know, they're safe assets. So there's not a lot of substitutes for treasuries. So there's that inelastic demand there. And of course, the Fed had bought a lot as well. I mean, where do you think the rates would be if we had an extra $5 trillion in coupons on the markets? So
Wait, I want you to answer that question.
Well, what do you think? Well, I think in that case, you know, an 8% mortgage rate would be a bargain.
Thank you. That's it. But I'm glad to know, because I think right. I think you raised that great point.
And I really liked your point about the convexity hedging by mortgage holders. And as I'm sure as you know, back let's say in 2007, Fannie and Freddie, they had these huge mortgage portfolios, and they were huge convexity hedgers. And they were really driving rate fall a lot higher. That's all gone now. But and the Fed is there, as Powell would say, their huge mortgage-backed securities portfolio is like a short volatility position, and that's unwinding as well. So we see the MOVE index creeping higher. A lot of that is just policy uncertainty. But if we have to have this huge, increasingly large private holder of mortgage-backed securities that hedges, well, that's another tailwind for rate fall. So this fixed income, this fixed income market has a lot of, not a lot of good news going for it. We have unstable inflation that could be higher. We have a lot of supply. We have convexity hedging, as you suggested. That this is the bedrock of the global financial system. If we have fragility here, and if something cracks, well, wow, that's everything is going to implode. But then the Fed will come and, you know, kind of open up, fire up the printers and, you know, buy everything again. And we all know what happens after that. But until that happens, it does seem that rates are going to go higher. And man, mortgage rates, yeah, that's going to hurt the housing market a lot. I'm so glad I have 2.7 mortgage. I'm never going to sell.
It's one of the things, because I hadn't had a mortgage in a long time. My wife, who's far more financially astute than I am, because she's a CPA and an MBA, and she said, oh no, we're taking out a mortgage because we moved down here to Arizona. I said, I don't, she says, no, we're taking, and it's finally, I can earn more on a 1-year treasury bill than my mortgage cost me. So I'm in the same, but it's been a long grind. You know, I'm one of those people who Janet Yellen and Ben Bernanke told me, stop crying and complaining, right? Yes, you're not earning anything, you know, as they would get the letters about, I'm not earning any interest on my money. No, but you're great. You know, and I really hated it because I thought they were talking to me like I was a kindergarten. Yes, but your grandchildren have jobs. Your house prices are going up. Your stock portfolio is going up. Yeah, you're not earning. You know what? I'm an old-fashioned investor. I know how to take risk, but I also want some reward for lending you my money, which you artificially. So I'd love to hear, but I'm amazed who could be buying this duration. When I look around, I mean, yeah, I understand insurance companies and I understand, but it's a global phenomenon because who would be buying European debt? Although I can buy, you know, I can make the case that I could actually, by using the ECB's own rules of a capital key, that I could almost get 10-year yields now in Europe. If I put together the same basket, so if I bought some Bunds and I bought some oats and I bought some Austrians and then I bought some Italians, I could almost get to 3.25%. But still, with a currency that's been going south, who's buying it? But more importantly, who's buying U.S. 10 years at 3.4% for the life of me? And I think the Fed takes false comfort in that because they think that's a vote on the confidence that they're going to win the inflation battle. But I'm not there yet. You know, to me, money is more intelligent. So I go, who's buying this?
I'll just add another angle to this. And, you know, like over the past few years, like the foreigners have obviously been a big holder of treasuries, and having them hold treasuries is a good anchor for rates. But you have to understand that a lot of treasuries are held by people who don't agree with the U.S., right? They're not on the same political spectrum. And that's a huge tail risk from what I see. Now, I think in the past, the powers separated politics from economy, right? That they broke that barrier down when they started confiscating the Russian sovereign reserves. So, you know, the Russian Central Bank held a bunch of money at the European Central Banks and maybe a little bit in treasuries at the Fed as well. I don't know about that. And now they just kind of basically froze them. So they basically took it away. Now, if you look just a little bit across the world, you'll see that the Chinese, they hold trillions in US treasuries and they're not on the same team as the US. And they've been very vocal that they view, let's say, Taiwan as a very, very important part of China. And so, you know, my family is from Taiwan, so we were familiar with all this stuff. So it's kind of like how Russia views Ukraine as a very, very important part of Russia, and they will do anything to make sure that doesn't run away. And so China also views Taiwan as part of China and will do anything to prevent it from running away. And China sees that, gosh, the West can confiscate my foreign reserves. So before they make a move on Taiwan, and they absolutely will, it's just really important to them, they're going to have to get rid of their treasury somehow, right? And that's trillions of dollars of not just, of selling that has to occur, or they can let it roll off. I don't know. And so not just who's going to buy, a lot of people who are holding this are going to have to get rid of it. And they hold a lot. So that's a huge, huge tail risk there. It's it's a national security issue, and it's a lot of fragility in the system. So the U.S. has a very open economy. There's strengths because of that, but there are also very many weaknesses, especially when we have so much liabilities that are held by other people.
Very good point. But so that raises the issue, because you brought up Waller's comments about, well, and Powell's actually talked about it too. How much is a trillion of QT in interest? But more importantly to me, what is a 15% appreciation of the dollar in interest for the global? Because again, everybody talks about the dollar as trade. To me, it's minimis. That was a 70s issue, right? And that prompted the Plaza Accord more than anything, because they were trying to build, the Republicans were trying to secure the Reagan Democratic base. So they wanted to protect, and talk about trade. But to me, now we're at 2022, and the dollar is a much more financial issue than it is a trade issue, because we don't benefit. If the dollar goes up and oil is $85, we don't get a benefit. It negatively affects those who have to convert euros into dollars to buy that oil. But for us, it's nothing. But for everybody who's borrowed in dollars, just like on the same side of QT, and Ed Yardini actually wrote a piece a couple of weeks ago, which I cited, where he talks about the same thing, the two things, quantitative tightening and the dollar. And may we have gotten to the actual neutral short-term rate, because we're not calculating the deleveraging effect of all of that, and that it's having a bigger role, and then just worry about quantitative tightening and stop raising rates. So you think that?
I think the dollar, so as you suggested, so, okay, so Powell goes to Congress and he says that, hiking rates stops inflation. And he names a few channels, and one of the channels he names is a stronger dollar. But as you correctly noted, that impacts the U.S. in a very different way, because the dollar is the currency of global trade. So when we have a stronger dollar, what we import actually doesn't become cheaper, because we were already paying in dollars. How it really affects the global economy is there everyone else who was buying stuff in dollars. So for example, a stronger dollar, what that means is, let's say you're Japan. Well, I'm buying oil, but oil is priced in dollars. Oil suddenly becomes more expensive. It doesn't affect us, because it was always priced in dollars, but it affects everyone else, because they were importing in dollars, and now dollars are more expensive. In a way, it's a masterful way of getting inflation down by forcing foreigners to consume less stuff. It makes the foreign economy much weaker. They basically have to tighten their belts, because they can't afford all this dollar-denominated stuff. So they cut back, and they bear the pain. And when they cut back, there's less demand and prices fall. It's a really good deal for the U.S. It's a really bad deal for everyone else. I'm going to push back on this idea of neutral rate a bit, because I know that the Fed likes to use it, and many economists do. But if you really think about it, what determines growth and inflation? There's tons of things that determine. Let's say, for example, right now, labor force participation, or your expectations of the future, or how easily you can get credit to fund a business, and that's all banking regulations. There's so many things that go into determining growth and inflation that the price of money set by the Fed, in my view, is not that big a part of it. And sometimes it can be, but it's just one thing out of many things. And one way to look at this is, post-GFC, we've had zero rates, and yet we've had very lackluster growth and inflation. So there's all these other things that depend upon it. And the Fed always looks at, the world as, and the ECB, all professional economists look at the world as the neutral rate. They're basically betting very highly on this idea of who, to me doesn't make a lot of sense. And the Fed thinks neutral rate is about, let's say, 50 basis points real, which according to Fed speeches is, well, if you look at inflation expectations being anchored at 2%, 2% plus 50 basis points is 2.5% nominal. Okay, if you want to bet on that, in my view, you could be betting on something that's very wrong, and you could actually risk that being not restrictive enough. And as you noted, Yara, that we're going, if we use a more near dated inflation expectations, we're still very, very negative in real rates right now. And so that concept that the Fed is using neutral rate could be leading the Fed to commit some very large policy errors that won't be easily corrected.
Yeah, that's, I'm sorry. Saying, going back to the dollar. So when they talk about its benefits, people talk about it benefits US inflation, the stronger dollar, only if they're successful in bringing, as you talk, if you bring the world to a disinflationary spiral due to a slowdown in growth, you will then have cheaper imports into the US because everybody's going to be dumping goods. I mean, we saw that in 2008 initially when the Chinese were busy dumping goods, right? Everybody had to protect them and protect themselves. They were afraid they needed to raise that, especially because you need dollars to fund your debt. You're going to dump whatever you can. So yes, that will, but the outcome of it, you don't really want the outcome of it, which will be a massive, forget 5.5% unemployment in the US. I think you'd go to 7-8 so quick, you wouldn't know, because the global situation. Well, so, and I'm not sure, all your points are very, very well taken, but.
I like
when you disagree with me. That's what we're here for.
Yeah, no, the dollar, definitely, I don't. Well, so I guess you're saying that if the way that they will handle weaker growth is just cut prices, and that will force the import prices the U.S. faces to go lower, and that hurts U.S. jobs because everyone will be buying from abroad rather than buying domestically. Yeah, right. That makes sense.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
Yeah, so, and then prices will come down, but you don't want them coming down. That's the only way the dollar could really bring your prices down, is that if the dollar goes high enough, you will, to me, crack the global financial edifice.
But do you feel like there's, so if you are the Fed, I mean, so as we've noted, so right now, Fed funds rate is not really high. Like historically speaking, it's still really low. What do you think would their best play be? Just to kind of do it slowly so that the dollar doesn't strengthen too much? Or
I would go and leave. Well, I can see December Fed funds are right now anticipating 4% by December. Well, if you're going to go there and inflation stays at 6%, you're still, I think you're okay, but I would say I'm stopping here and let's see what quantitative tightening is, what's going to be the real, how much deleveraging of the system is going to take place with quantitative tightening. I think that would give the world a little bit more. First of all, everybody else is now being forced because the United States is not running interference for the Europeans anymore. So you got the European hawks, or the Hanseatic Five, the Germans, the Austrians, the Dutch, a few more who are really pushing back at Lagarde. But if the United States were to slow that down, because Lagarde already said they're not going to quantitative tightening, they can't go, because she has to protect against fragmentation of the spread, credit spreads. So she can't, if she loses that battle, I don't know what's going to take place. It will not be good for the global financial system, because the ECB is carrying a balance sheet that's enormous. So they've got, there's all kinds of, the world is fraught with credit risks that, as you say, what's going to set it? I don't know. I'm hoping that it doesn't set it in motion, because I think it's far more. Now, I think at times the Fed is very comfortable because they put in that standing repo facility, which when I measure it, probably in realistic terms, because there's such a huge foreign component to it, maybe close to $2 trillion. And if they needed immediate liquidity, which they only put that in place right after you left, I think, July of 2021, that they think that they can provide this, the global system, with enough liquidity. We'll see. I'm hoping it doesn't get tested, because I don't think things will be very good then.
I think the global deleveraging is a real risk. Now, if you think back, let's say in during the GFC, one of the big problems was that what everyone thought were safe assets were not safe assets, right? So they incurred losses on what they thought they were safe assets, and then that prompted the big deleveraging. Now, everyone thinks today sovereign debt is a safe asset, and that's right. There's no credit risk. But what if, let's say, inflation is very high, issuance, and all this fragility in the treasury market that we've been discussing, what if that causes, let's say, prices to decline significantly, yields to go higher? Then what you thought were safe assets, you know, really, it's kind of like a AAA, you know, private label and mortgage taking a big haircut, right? You could have that similar deleveraging dynamic, and that would truly be catastrophic. Now, the repo facility, that's a liquidity thing. So that means that you'll get liquidity. That's important, but that doesn't really protect you against price declines. So that that helps, but it's if we have this strange, if we have a world where there's a huge sovereign debt sell-off, repo facility will help, but I don't know if it'll be enough. The Fed will have to come in, basically do yield curve control.
Yeah, I think your point is, well, they don't think they're going to see a solvency issue. But if the breaking of the global deleveraging reveals that there's far more risk out there than they calculated, then we will wind up, and right, the standing repo facility, it's a liquidity provider. It's not a solvency. And if we get into, as you rightly talk about, the great finance, you know, if we get into the GFC again, they're going to get blindsided because they really think the banks are healthy enough to withstand this.
And given all these risks and the environment, what are your thoughts on the U.S. dollar? I mean, we've had some weakening recently, but do you see it getting stronger again, maybe going stronger than 110 on the index?
You know, today it's September 13th, and we've had a very hot core inflation print. Market is pricing in a higher Fed funds rate, as Yara has mentioned. So, you know, this seems to be set up for a stronger dollar, since the Fed market is thinking the Fed is going to hike more. So, you mean, currency is always a relative thing. If you look at the Eurozone, they're also pricing at a more aggressive ECB. But there's a lot more constraints the ECB has when it comes to hiking policy. There's the fragmentation issues that Yara mentioned, and they just don't have as strong an economy as the US. So if we're going to be hiking together, the U.S. can go much farther than the ECB, and the Bank of Japan isn't even hiking at all. So I think that the dollar can continue to strengthen from going forward.
Your thoughts, Ira?
No, I couldn't agree more. I never agree with Alan Greenspan. It's a coin toss. I'm a currency trader. It's what I brought to the table for 45, 46 years. It's where my work begins. So I think that there's just many things you have to watch. And there's so many moving parts, which always makes it interesting. I mean, today we have a 2% rally in the dollar off of a CPI number where the market was leaning towards a softer number. I mean, this move has been, do I dare say, breathtaking for what really took place here. Because again, the outlier was that yesterday, even as the equity markets rallied, the precious metals rallied, the dollar got sold off. The one thing that was an outlier was that the December Fed funds closed on its low contract lows yesterday. And today it dropped another 20 basis points. So that was an outlier saying, somebody is not on board with a softer CPI number. So, and that proved very prescient. That's the one that mattered, because it never moved yesterday. And I kept looking at it. I go, how can the dollar be weak today? It's being sold off the equity market. I said, they're looking for a softer number, but the Fed funds is not telling me that whatsoever. But
no, it looks like the Fed funds people are smarter than the equity people. And it's a good time to be a currency trader now. You know, there's so much volatility, so much macro. Just like a pre-COVID, FX vol was really low. There was not much to talk about. It was kind of a sleepy place. But now it's a very exciting place.
It is. But dealing with the algorithms, you I've really had to slow my mojo down, so to speak, and wait for them, because they're not fundamentally based. They just trade momentum and price. That's all they see. That's all they don't care anything around it. Sometimes they'll look for some correlations of certain commodity currency, but they don't. They're very short-lived. So then you have to be able to step in and go, well, there's bigger things here. What am I looking at? Or nothing at all. But I think Joseph is 100% right. So that's where that leaves us.
Great. It's been a fascinating discussion. Your final thoughts, Joseph, and also how can our listeners, viewers learn more about your work?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for inviting me. It was a pleasure chatting today. It was very interesting for me, and I've learned stuff as well. I write a blog, FedGuy.com, where I talk about what's happening in the markets from a planning perspective. And if you're interested in the financial system, I also have a book called Central Banking 101. It's on Amazon. It's very well reviewed. Check it out if you're interested in learning about central banking. So my core view right now is that I think the lows are not in for the risk assets. We're probably going to have to retest, probably going to go below the recent lows, and rates are going much higher. I think that the 10-year will go, let's say, above 4% by the end of the year. So, and that has a whole bunch of knock-on effects, stronger dollar, lower risk assets. So it's going to be an exciting time for the next, foreseeable future, I think.
Yes, indeed. Exactly. Great. And your thoughts, Ira, and how can our listeners learn?
No,
about you?
There's nothing I'm going to disagree with there at this point in time. It's in flux. I think Joseph gives you a very good view from the Fed, which is extremely important. And you know what? Hopefully, I'll really get back to writing notes from underground. I try to really be on top of the global macro world. I think it's so dynamic and change is far more. I wish the Fed would be, and I know when you make policy, you can't always jump around, but I think they're a little slow on the uptake. They get slow one way and then they'll pursue this and be slow to adjust if they need to adjust. They just don't do it well. But as Joseph and I talked about, I'm interested to see when Lori Logan I'm sure she's seated now for the next meeting. So I'm waiting to hear better market impact, because I think Lori Logan did a good job running SOMA. And I think the Fed I know that those voices are there, but I think when the voices get out front, that it's better. I think there's too many people sitting in that room who don't respect markets enough. And I think when you sit at the SOMA, you respect markets. I think so much so that they may scare you at times, and you have to go back to your bosses and go, this is what we're seeing. So I think that's actually good for policy going forward. So I'm actually excited. And I'm waiting to hear from Philip Jefferson and Lisa Cook, because everybody made such a big deal about their appointments. I need to hear the labor economists speak as to what they're on board with here. So,
yeah, I agree. I would like to hear what they're thinking too.
Great. Thank you very much, Joseph and Ira. Thank you.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.